America at a Crossroads is a weekly live webinar series that brings together journalists, scholars, thought leaders, and policymakers for discussions regarding the state of American democracy, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. The series was jointly founded by Jews United for Democracy and Justice and Community Advocates, Inc. To register for our live webinars, join our email list at JewsUnitedForDemocracy.org.
Now for tonight's program, Pat Morrison is a columnist at the LA Times. She has an extraordinarily long and esteemed career as a broadcast journalist, for which she has won countless awards, including Pulitzers and Golden Mics. We are very pleased now to turn this hour over to the wonderful Pat Morrison. Pat?
Janice, thank you. And thank you to all of you who watch and to make this program possible. It's become a linchpin and a necessity for those of us who are trying to navigate our way through these difficult times in our democracy. Marty Baron was my colleague at the Los Angeles Times for a number of years, also the executive editor of the Miami Herald, at the Boston Globe as well, where the paper won a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage, its expose of the Catholic Church sex scandal there, which also triggered a number of similar investigations across the country. And most recently, as the executive editor of the Washington Post from 2013 to 2021, the subject of this book, which we're going to be discussing tonight, The Collision of Power, Trump, Bezos, and the Washington Post, one of the most eminent journalists and editors in America. And we're very happy he could make time to be here. Marty, thanks. It's always good to see you again.
Yeah, great to see you, Pat. Thanks for having me.
It's been almost 9 years since Donald Trump descended that gold elevator. And the question for journalists and for non-journalists alike all those years, and a louder question now, is how Trump has changed journalism. And we've talked a lot about how he's changed the country, but how he's changed journalism is a big part of that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think he was a candidate unlike any we'd ever seen before in 2015 and 2016, and then became a president unlike any we'd ever seen before, and now again a candidate unlike any we'd ever, a former president unlike any we'd ever seen before. And I think the press really struggled with how to cover him the first time around, struggled quite a bit with covering him as president. And I think is still learning lessons as it tries to cover him today. So I think he did change journalism in a lot of ways. I think there were a lot of norms in our business that we set aside, some for the better and some for the worse. And I think that people are trying to figure out, you know, what is the best way to cover him?
For all of you in our audience, if you have a question for Marty, we'll get to them a little later in this hour, and you can put them in the Q&A, and we'll be able to come around to those. And please tell us your first name and where you are from in your question. So Marty, to talk about how he has changed journalism, a lot of the argument, both outside and within journalism, is that this is covering this era of Trump is a different job, and different jobs require different tools. And the argument is that that's true of journalism as well. Do you think that's the case?
Well, I think we have the tools that we need. I think we're dealing with a candidate who's really difficult to cover. We get a lot of advice on how to cover him. A lot of people say, don't report what he says because you're normalizing him. And then if you don't report what he says, they say, how could you not report what he said? It was so outrageous. So you get a lot of contradictory advice on that. My sense is that what we really ought to be focusing on today is really on what he intends to do if he were to get back into the White House, in the same way that we should report on what Biden might do in a second term as well. But a lot of the things that Trump is talking about, he's talking about them openly, and a lot of them are the kinds of measures that have been implemented in other countries where you had aspiring authoritarians. And those are the kinds of measures that they put into place, using the military to suppress protests, going after your political enemies by using the by prosecuting them, bringing treason charges against people you deem to be unfavorable to you, including former members of his administration, but also members of the press, eliminating the civil service and installing loyalists in every level of government. So these are the kinds of measures that we've seen in other countries that are have become authoritarian in nature. I think that we should really be focusing on that, in addition to what kinds of laws he intends to exploit in order to implement those measures, or what kinds of laws he intends to bend or break in order to implement those measures, and who he would put in charge to carry out these the kinds of measures that he's talking about.
Just so you know, in the audience, we're very aware that we don't have closed captioning this evening, and we're very sorry that we can't deliver that to you this evening because of some of these technical issues that you may be witnessing. But Marty, Trump has issued such a fire hose of these kinds of threats and outrageous comments for years that you wonder how those of us in journalism, and then our audience, our readers, our viewers, are able to process it when we've heard so much of this kind of thing before. And how much do people turn off what they're hearing, and how hard is it within our business to make sure that people know that this is still what's going on and may even be escalating? And he's not joking.
Well, it's true that a lot of people have just decided that they don't want to hear anymore, that troubles them so much, that gives them anxiety. In fact, there are a number of doctors out there actually who are recommending that people not watch or read the news because it makes them more anxious. I would discourage that myself, because I think that we should be aware of what's actually happening. But keep in mind, I mean, any one media outlet only reaches a small portion of the population. You know, only about 8% of the American public live New York Times as the primary, as its primary source of news. It's something like 3% for the Washington Post. So no matter what you're doing, you're not necessarily reaching everybody in the population. Even the big cable networks, if you actually look at their total audience, it's relatively small. So people are getting their information from all sorts of different sources. And I use the word information broadly, because a lot of it is misinformation, and in some instances, actual disinformation, deliberate falsehoods that are being spread.
Let me ask you about that point about get their information from. Years ago, a colleague of ours in the Washington Bureau, Paul Houston, was covering a protest during the Carter administration when interest rates went very high and farmers were having a hard time. They converged on Washington with their farm equipment to protest. And Paul was out there covering it when he saw a woman stuck trying to get out of Washington that day, very angry, getting out of her car, shaking her fist, saying, "I don't need you farmers. I get my food at the grocery store." So I think print journalists find themselves in the same position. People say, "I don't read the New York Times. I don't read the Washington Post or the LA Times." But a lot of what they are reading that is news comes from these newspapers at a time when newspapers, especially smaller ones, are very much under threat. Journalists are losing their jobs at a rate faster than coal miners. So we have the two threads. We have the idea that news is coming still from these old media companies, and that the way that we can report on these is quickly disappearing.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, certainly what the New York Times publishes or the Washington Post publishes, what the LA Times publishes, can get amplified and gets onto television, gets onto the cable networks, gets onto radio. So it gets spread through social media, so it can have a greater impact. But the problem is right now is that we have, because of the internet, because people can turn to sources of information that affirm their pre-existing points of view, we have in many instances, in too many instances, a society that doesn't share a common set of facts. And it's actually worse than that. We can't even agree on how to establish that something is a fact. So the kinds of things that we traditionally have used to establish something as a fact have been greatly devalued in our society, unfortunately. Things like education, expertise, experience, and worst of all, actual evidence, so that in many instances, such as what we saw on January 6th of 2021, people are denying what they saw with their own eyes and heard with their own ears, and for which there's an enormous volume of evidence, and yet people will call that normal civic discourse, as the Republican Party did, or as some members of that party have said, sort of a typical tourist visit. Although I have never actually received a brochure advertising that kind of tourism myself.
To the extent that journalism has changed, one of the things that was noticeable was a debate in many newsrooms that resulted in the fact that some of Trump's comments were called racist. Some of his comments were called lies. And it took a long time to get there. So journalism responded, maybe not as much as some people wanted or as quickly. But now journalists do feel a sense that, yes, I can characterize what it is this man is saying.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I think it's not a bad thing. And it's certainly a tradition in our business to be careful with the words we use. And I think we should be careful with the words we use, because once we use a word, we can't take it back. And you have to be careful that the language that you're using itself just doesn't become a target. And the result is that people pay less attention to the actual facts of the matter and the nature of the falsehood, as opposed to the sort of incendiary language that's being used. But yes, it did become apparent that in lots of instances, Trump was not just self-deluded, and he was not just sort of paying, he couldn't care less whether something was true or false, and just making it up as, in whatever way served his own interest, but that he actually knew that things were false, and he said them anyway. And that's become ever more clear over time, particularly with regard to the 2020 election, and that he lost that election, and to what happened, for example, on January 6th of 2021. So I think in those kinds of instances, we're on very safe ground saying that he's lying. He knew that he absolutely knows that what he is saying is false, and yet he's saying it anyway because it serves his own interests.
Your book deals with the period when Jeff Bezos bought and his ownership of the Washington Post, which parallels much of the Trump administration. So let's talk something about that. And first of all, why Jeff Bezos wanted to buy the Washington Post?
Well, you know, I mean, it's hard to get into his head, but I can tell you what he said and what I believe. I mean, he talked about that, you know, he had to go through several gates. One was to assure himself that it was an important institution, to which he said, yes, of course. He had to make sure that he could be optimistic about its future, because if he didn't have hope for the future, he would feel sorry for us, but he wouldn't want to join us. And then he said, you know, did he have something to contribute? And he said he thought a lot about that. And he concluded that, yes, he could give us obviously what he called runway, which was time. He could make investments and let them play out over a period of time and see if they worked. He also, I mean, he did bring other things, which was obviously an understanding of technology, a sophisticated understanding of technology, and a sophisticated understanding of consumer sales. And of course, our business is in consumer sales. But I also think, and this is going to sound naive because we're talking about Jeff Bezos, who's one of the richest people in the world, and on any one day, the richest person in the world. And so people say, well, he can't have any noble motives. But I actually do believe that he believes in the press. And I think that's been borne out based on his ownership of the Post, that he believes in the role of the press, even though he's become the target of it, and that he believes in American democracy, and he just feels the press plays an important role in that. And he also felt, I think, that the Post could be turned around. We were in a position that we were kind of sliding into oblivion. We did not have a successful business model when he acquired us. We were our strategy at the time was to be fundamentally regional. Of course, we covered national politics, but the motto at the time was foreign about Washington. And so other than national politics, we focused on our region. And Bezos said that may have worked in the past and did, was profitable, but that it couldn't serve us in the future, that we could be national and international for a variety of reasons, and that we had a unique ability to do that. And that we now had the capacity to deliver our journalism digitally as opposed to delivering a newspaper, which meant that we could acquire additional readers and additional subscribers at effectively no incremental cost. And so he said, we'll take the gift that the internet is giving to you, even though the internet has damaged so much of your business, take the gift. And you can be national because you're based in the nation's capital. You have the name to Washington Post, and you have a history and heritage going back to Watergate, such that there are millions of people around the country and around the world who know of the Washington Post, have a great impression of the Washington Post for holding power to account, particularly going back to Watergate, but they've never even read a word of the Washington Post. So that is a base to build upon, and the internet is giving us this gift, and we should build upon that. So he saw the capacity to turn around the Post, which most people did not see, including many people who worked within the Post. And I think he saw that he could actually make a difference. And so for a variety of those reasons, I think he bought it. He has not used it to exercise influence. He's been accused of that by Trump over and over and over again. But there's no evidence of that. And the reason there's no evidence for that is because he's never actually done it.
Your book was published after you left the paper, but the review of your book said it was three books in one. So you bargain hunters, be aware, the three books in one, an insider's revealing examination of, sorry about the little kibitz in here, revealing examination of Bezos' stewardship of the Post, a sometimes thriller of a tale about how the Post navigated a perilous time in journalism, and a chronicle of how Trump tried mightily to discredit the Post and sink Amazon. You had a seat at the table for a lot of that relationship with Bezos and Trump. And my sense is that Trump probably expected, hey, us rich guys, we're going to stick together. Can you talk about some of the dealings that Bezos and Trump had and some of the dealings you had with Trump individually as well?
Sure. Well, I think it all came to a head in a meeting that we had about 5 months after Trump took office. Our publisher wanted, and this is in the prologue to the book, our publisher felt that it would be a good idea if we all met with Trump. Bezos had actually met with him previously as part of a group of technology executives, but he was also had a private meeting before that where Trump, talked about how he liked Amazon, but he didn't like the Post so much. But when we had our meeting at the White House, it was for dinner, and our publisher felt it would be good to meet with him. I was there, the publisher was there, Bezos was there, our editorial page editor, Jared Kushner, Melania, and of course the president. And throughout the entire time, I was sitting next to his left. Throughout that entire dinner, he was criticizing the Post, called us the worst of all media outlets frequently. And every time he would criticize the Post for something, he would elbow me to his left. I was quite tempted to elbow him back, but you just don't do that with the President of the United States.
Well, with the Secret Service there, certainly not.
Yeah. And then he called Bezos the actual next morning and said, can't you, I don't know whether you get involved in news coverage or not, but I'm sure you do. To some extent, is how he put it, contradicting himself. He said, isn't there something you can do to make the Post more fair to me? And Bezos told him that he did not get involved in the news coverage and that if he did, he would regret it for the rest of his life. And then Trump, at the end of that conversation on the cell phone, said, basically invited Bezos to ask for a favor. He said, if there's anything that you ever need, just give me a call. Bezos thankfully never did give him a call, never did ask for a favor, and in fact was the subject of constant attacks, efforts to raise postal rates in order to hurt Amazon, intervention and a $10 billion cloud computing contract where Amazon was considered, at least initially, to be the leading bidder, and Trump wanted to make sure it did not go to Amazon, and initially it did not. And then Trump called me afterwards. I mean, I think he called me a couple of times afterwards to complain about stories. The last time he called, I mean, in one instance, he called and he said that he had been portrayed like a little boy. And then he said these words that I never expected to hear from a president of the United States. He said, I am not a little boy, which I just could not believe I was hearing that from a president of the United States. And the second time he called to complain again and said that it was all because of this negative coverage, was because of me, was because of Bezos, was because of Amazon, which I was irritated to hear yet again directly from him. And I said, well, it's not, and you know it's not. And I think he is not used to that kind of a confrontation. And he blurted out a bunch of profanities and then said we were just a hate machine and a big fat lie. He basically blamed Bezos and Amazon again. After that, he had no more contact with Bezos, and he had no more contact with me, but he did make every effort to try to undermine the business of Amazon and to demonize, of course, the Post, of course, the press in general, but to go beyond demonizing us, really to dehumanize the press. And it's really, that to me is, it's hard to be shocked anymore, but that to me is still shocking.
And Trump, of course, doesn't have any real sense of fairness. His idea of fairness is favorable coverage.
That's what he views as fair. It's basically, it has to be, you can see this play out not only in his relationship with the press, but in his relationship with other politicians. It's, you can never dissent. You can never break away from him on anything. It has to be 100% loyalty, 100% support, not 99%, 100%. That's what he considers to be fair. That's what he considers to be right. And that is his expectation of the press as well. And you can even see that in his, with regard to the press, you can see that in his relationship, for example, with Fox. If Fox ever veers from him or even actually airs his opponent or a critic, he starts attacking Fox and saying that that's inappropriate. He just doesn't feel that anybody but himself should have an opportunity to have a voice, and that none of his critics should actually be allowed to say what they say, and that he views all that criticism as being unfair.
It's about 7 years now since the motto, "Democracy Dies in Darkness," was unveiled, just a couple of weeks into the Trump presidency. And your sense of it wasn't quite what you might have wanted it to be. Your phrase was, "We're not at war with the administration, we're at work." And yet that the saying has certainly resonated with a lot of people because darkness seems to be the alternative.
Yeah, that phrase was not really a reaction to the motto. I think we had a hard time with that motto. We spent 2 years on it. It wasn't a reaction to Trump. It just happened to be introduced at the time that Trump took office and was interpreted that way. That was a phrase that was meant to sort of signal the distinct role that the Washington Post can play in Washington and should play in Washington, which is holding power to account, which is a historic role of the Washington Post. Obviously did that in the case of Richard Nixon, but it's done that with presidents, both Republican and Democratic. The phrase, "We're not at war with the administration, we're at work," came several weeks after Trump was in office. Trump, on his first full day in office, went to the CIA, with whom he already had a troubled relationship because of their investigation of Russia's intervention in the election. And standing in front of a memorial to fallen CIA agents, of course, what did he talk about but the press? And he said, "As you know, I'm in a running war with the media," seeming to want to enlist the intelligence agency in his own war with the media. Several weeks after that, I was asked for my reaction to that. And I said, "We're not at war with the administration, we're at work." And what I meant by that is that we really have to look back to why we have a free and independent press in this country. James Madison, who was the principal author of the First Amendment, talked about freely examining public characters and measures. So public characters, obviously politicians, government officials, people with authority, measures, policies, of course, free. We should understand that word. But examining is the key word here. That means that journalism is not stenography. It is digging beneath the surface, looking behind the curtain, finding who did what, why, with what intent, who influenced those decisions, and for what purpose. Those are the kinds of things that journalism exists to do, and it exists to hold power to account, particularly political power. That is why we have a free and independent press in this country, and I view that as the original assignment from the founders of this country to the press. We have essentially a near sacred duty to fulfill that obligation, and if we don't, we are not doing our jobs.
On that point, I'm wondering what you think a second Trump term might look like when it comes to the press. There's every indication that this Supreme Court looks willing to revisit New York Times versus Sullivan, which is one of the fundamental court decisions that underpins a free press in this country, the ability to criticize public figures.
Yeah, well, my expectation is that Trump will not wait for the Supreme Court to rule. I think he will try to go after the press immediately and in a very aggressive manner. I think that he will, that if there's any disclosure of national security information, classified national security information, I would expect that he's going to bring a prosecution for that. That historically has not been prosecuted, but I would imagine that a Trump Justice Department will do that at the drop of a, you know, of a hat. And I would expect that he's talked about challenging the broadcast license for NBC because he's accused NBC and Comcast, which owns NBC and MSNBC, of treason for coverage that he deems to be unfavorable to him. So he's talked about that. I believe that he will try to damage the finances of major media organizations and possibly use that as an opportunity for his allies to acquire them, as has happened in countries like Venezuela and in other authoritarian regimes where media organizations are being weakened, and then political allies of an authoritarian leader come and take control of those media organizations for their own purposes. So I think that there are, and I also think he will encourage his allies, as I believe he has done in the past, to bring these libel suits that you mentioned, and to saddle, whether they win or lose, to saddle press organizations with enormous costs of defending themselves. And so I would expect to see that too. And I think that he would want to try to test the New York Times versus Sullivan case.
We have a lot of questions on this point, and I'll start going to your questions. And if you who are watching have questions, go to the Q&A part as you see on your Zoom and enter your question there. Your name and where you're from would be very helpful. So several have asked, so many small news outlets are being bought out by large media companies or just closing down. How do you see this as affecting, detrimental to the democracy as the news sources are getting smaller and smaller, given that so many Americans have often said it's local news that is their news source?
Yeah, well, I think the crisis in local news is the single biggest crisis in journalism today. We face many challenges, political ones like we've talked about, financial ones even at the national level. But clearly local and regional news outlets have suffered the most. And I mean, there are certain signs of some success of certain news organizations that are doing okay, but many of them are suffering greatly. And the types of major news organizations, if you want to call it that, that are acquiring newspapers are largely hedge funds and private equity firms. It's not traditional news organizations that are acquiring them. And they are treating local news organizations essentially like annuities, basically extracting every last penny they can get out of them through the sale of real estate, through whatever means they can, significant cost cuts, with no real care about their long-term sustainability and their long-term survival, as long as they achieve a good return on their investment. So that is, I think, a huge concern. Countering that are a number of nonprofits that have sprung up around the country. That's a model that's still, I would say, emerging. It still needs to be tested. That would require significant support from within local communities. It's not clear yet that there's enough philanthropic money for news, independent news coverage in this country to support a lot of nonprofits. But it is something that is being tried and tried very energetically today.
When people ask me what they can do to help newspaper journalism, I, of course, say subscribe to the paper where you live, but also wherever you've come from, subscribe to the main paper in the capital of that state, because coverage of what's going on in that state, the politics and the culture and everything else, is vital to this system where the states, as we know from the Electoral College, the states matter so much. So to support that level of journalism and local journalism is really vital. So it's I hope something that has been of use to people who are looking for ways to
support. There are many major newspapers that have maybe only one person covering state government. And obviously state government is huge. It's a single reporter, and the state capital is incapable of covering the entirety of state government or any portion of it really well. And many of these the biggest newspapers in certain states have nobody actually in Washington covering their representatives in Congress.
Let's hear from Charlotte from Falls First Church, Virginia, who says Trump thrives on publicity. Is he getting too much free coverage now? What are the boundaries that journalists should observe so as not to overboost him? And Marty, I remember 2016, it's like Trump was free wallpaper for CNN.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, he is going to be the Republican nominee. That's obvious that he will be. So you have to cover him as the Republican nominee. So it's like free publicity means we're not going to cover one of the leading candidates and the person who's actually today leading in the polls, regardless of whether we care about the polls at this stage or not. But clearly the major party candidate, you can't ignore him. On the other hand, I do think that there have been mistakes already, akin to what happened in 2016. So as you mentioned, in 2016, CNN and Fox carried his rallies from beginning to end, without any intermediary, nobody saying that what he was saying wasn't true, just carrying it. It was all free, essentially a free in-kind contribution to the Trump campaign. So more recently, you know, you had CNN do a long interview with Donald Trump, right at the beginning of the primaries. I think that was way too early. And I don't think there was a journalistic justification for doing that. The reality was that that CNN was trying to demonstrate at that point that it welcomed Republicans as much as it welcomed Democrats. So it was a PR motive for doing that. The same was true, I think, when there was a new host for Meet the Press. They had an interview with Donald Trump. The purpose there was to promote the new host for Meet the Press. That to me is not a good justification for having an interview with him. And he does, because of his the way he comports himself, he just dominates these interviews and then utters an enormous number of falsehoods. You know, there will have to be interviews with him, but I think that there was no need for those interviews at that time.
How much has the kind of click-driven journalism influenced major newspapers? And, you know, certainly online news sources or arguable news sources, instead of writing a headline that says, you know, Trump declares, kick out the immigrant day, it would say, guess what day Trump has declared? And you have to click on it in order to read it. Whereas the headline for legitimate, may I use the word, newspapers, does that job for you.
Yeah, you know, the reality, you don't see much of those headlines in major news organizations anymore. The reality is that the economic sort of foundation of online operations has changed substantially. It's very much built on subscribers, and subscribers are not looking for that. They're acquiring a subscription because they expect you to live up to certain standards, and they don't go for the clickbait. They go for in-depth stories. They go for investigations, accountability work, great narratives, journalism that actually is distinct and special in some way, and that is not commoditized in any way. So those kinds of headline tricks are not how major news organizations are operating these days.
Ruth in Rochester, Minnesota, speaks clearly from personal and frustrating experience, asking, how do you approach a discussion with someone who's fallen for disinformation that they've gotten from social media or such sources as Fox or One America Network?
Yeah, it's a tough question. And I've been asked that before. Just showing them a story from, let's say, the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, not going to help because they don't trust those outlets. We have a highly, highly polarized media consumption in this country. I do think it might help, and I say might, if you can point them to original source documents. So let's say we're talking about a court case. Let's say we're talking about January 6th or the 2020 election. Find the ruling, and these are available from major news outlets. Find the ruling from Trump-appointed judges who have weighed in on the kind of case that Donald Trump and his allies tried to make, arguing that the election was stolen, and how Trump-appointed judges have rejected those arguments and pointing out that no evidence, no credible evidence has been offered. And you can do—you don't have to do that with one judge. You can do that with multiple Trump-appointed judges and show that it's not just one, you know, well, Trump would call that a bad judge or a biased judge, but you can show that it's all of the Trump-appointed judges. So to the extent that you can point to original source documents, that's what I would point to.
Cassie wants to know more about the idea about viable models for financing independent journalism if it isn't to be hedge funds or billionaires.
Well, as I said, some people are trying nonprofits and trying to raise money locally and raise money from foundations. I think that's yet to be tested, really, although some have been, you know, reasonably successful. So, for example, in California, you have Cal Matters. In Texas, you have the Texas Tribune. You have some at the national level, ProPublica for investigations, Marshall Project for criminal justice. So you have that. You also have some, that are actually succeeding at the national level and at the local level. I mean, the reality is, I think the Boston Globe, where I worked for 11 and a half years, is in a pretty sustainable place right now. I think in San Francisco, it seems to me that paper in San Francisco is doing, the Chronicle is doing reasonably well. Obviously it doesn't have the resources it used to, but it's doing reasonably well. I think that's true in Minneapolis also. So I think there's some actual traditional and legacy news organizations that are doing okay. There are a variety that are becoming much more specialized in their approach. They're not so much geographic. So, for example, Chalkbeat, which covers education, it's a nonprofit, but it also has a lot of local sites. So it's covering education in different cities. So it's specializing. It's specializing in that way. An outfit called Platformer is covering the big tech companies, and it's broken a lot of news and seems to be doing pretty well. The Information, which is based in San Francisco, covers the intersection of media and tech. So there are, you know, there are success stories out there, and I think that our business is being really radically reinvented, and we're not quite sure how it's all going to shake out. But as long as we have a democracy, I think there'll be a demand for journalism. I think democracy is the big question mark at the moment. But as long as we have one, I think there will be demand for journalism.
On that point, Jack from Santa Barbara asks whether an NPR PBS model for a national newspaper with local affiliates would help to increase public trust in news. Of course, we had Gannett, which worked for a while and now has rejected Associated Press, not using Associated Press. You wonder where that's going. But is that a good model for?
I think he's talking about a government funded model, a partially government funded model, probably like PBS or NPR.
It doesn't allude to that, but we'll put aside the funding question for the moment. Just the idea of a network with affiliates, maybe.
Well, You had that in the past, as you point out. Gannett is a national, as papers across the country. Knight Ritter was a chain that I worked for when I was at the Miami Herald, which had papers in Philadelphia, Charlotte, San Jose, Detroit, a whole bunch of places. I don't think that's the answer to any of this. I think that the reality is that the way that people are consuming news today and the way that advertising is being distributed is the big challenge. So much of the advertising is being sucked up by the big platforms, and that would be Google, Facebook, Apple, less and less Twitter.
Susan from Boynton Beach, Florida says, what do you think of the hiring and firing of Ronna McDaniel, who was fired by the RNC but then taken up by NBC? And there was outrage among Republicans that she was fired from there.
Well, I think there's good reason not to hire her, and that is that she lied about the election and actively worked to undermine that election. I don't think that somebody like that should be on a network offering analysis. And I'm not sure she can actually offer an analysis any different than anything anybody else can offer, frankly. And I am really...
We're having a little bit of trouble with Marty's internet.
About the sort of revolving door between government and the networks. And there's a lot of that. How is this now? Is that better?
I think, Yes, thank you.
Is that better?
Yes, it is. Go ahead.
I apologize. I'm sorry. I have this storm here. In any event, I'm kind of concerned about the revolving door between between government and the networks, and I would discourage that. I think that the press really ought to be independent, and to the extent that you're hiring people who are essentially spokespeople for a party or a candidate, I think that raises questions about who are they really working for when they're on air.
There's a question from Paul in Manhattan Beach as to whether editorial boards and opinion pages still carry weight in communities, or are they just ineffective due to ardent partisan politics? Now, I know that the LA Times, they interview, for example, all the candidates for judgeships, and that's not really a group of races that people follow very closely. And so I know many people who use such recommendations for their voting when they don't know the candidates. But the overall question is the clout and the voice, whether or not it carries the clout that it used to or to this day.
Well, I'm not sure it ever carried as much clout as we think it did, frankly. I think there's a legitimate question. I mean, the New York Times has cut back significantly on the number of editorials that it publishes. I think there's a concern about people not being able to distinguish between what's opinion and what's news. And it looks so muddled online. Secondly, I do think that where editorials can make a difference is in the areas you're talking about, certain kinds of races that people aren't paying attention to, issues locally, for example, with smaller local newspapers, where they can draw attention to issues and illuminate those issues in a way that, you know, the ordinary person is just not focusing on that.
We have a question, kind of a career question from Tina in Portland, who says, our granddaughter is in college and really wants to be a journalist. What would you tell her?
Well, I'm sorry to tell you, I always tell people to ignore their parents. And I'll include grandparents here because they always think that you shouldn't go into journalism. My own parents thought I should probably go into the law and to become a lawyer. And while I was interested in law, I wasn't interested in becoming a lawyer. I think if somebody has a passion for the field, they should go into the field that they have a passion for. I wanted to go into a field that I thought would always be interesting and meaningful, and I found one. And so, and I think a lot of young people are looking for exactly that today. Our field is going to change dramatically. I don't think people should judge the opportunity strictly by what's happening on the employment front at traditional legacy news organizations. They will have to be entrepreneurial, either within an organization or on their own. And they will have to learn a lot of new skills. And if they do that, if they're willing to embrace the new things that they have to learn, if they're willing and able to do that, they have the capacity to actually have an accelerated career and to jump over people at traditional organizations who are unwilling or unable change the way that they should.
Apologies for the commentary being run by my fur baby right now. Linda, who is a retired Associated Press person, I think I know who she is, my friend. Would you be willing, Marty, to get back into the news business as a powerful voice to help save the industry? We'll get you your white horse. I think we can do a GoFundMe.
I think I know that, Linda. No, I retired. So I don't want to manage people anymore. And I did that for most of my career and 20 years as the top editor of a news organization. So I want to be involved in our profession, but in a very different way. One way I did that was by writing this book and talking and going around talking about it, kinds of things that I address in the book. And I'll have to figure out what my next act is. I don't know what that is at the moment, but I don't want to go back into running a news organization.
Neil has a question. What is your opinion about so-called neutral news sources such as All Sides and Epoch Times? I, in fact, just saw a billboard for the Epoch Times on Beverly Boulevard here a couple of days ago, talking about number one American neutral news.
Well, I'm afraid it's not neutral by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, Epoch Times is part of essentially a group in China that owns Epoch Times, and it's closely aligned with Trump, trying to advance the interests of Trump. There's nothing neutral about it. So I think people should be careful when somebody describes themselves as neutral, and be careful of that kind of advertising on the part of Epoch Times. It might well be the last place I would look for neutral coverage.
I think it was Christiane Amanpour of CNN who said, be truthful, not neutral. What do you make of that advice?
Well, I think I'm in favor of objectivity, but I don't think that equates to false equivalence or both sidesism, or on the one hand, on the other hand, journalism or neutrality. And that's a word that I wouldn't use. I use objectivity, which means that, and that's a concept that goes back more than 100 years to Walter Lippmann, who popularized it. And that means going into our reporting with an open mind, being willing and wanting to talk to all people you need to talk to, looking at all the evidence, doing so rigorously, thoroughly, and fairly, being fair to everyone you talk to, being fair to the evidence, but also being fair to the public, which means that you do all that work in order to get at the truth, right? To get at the reality and the facts. And you have an the reason you do all that work is so you can tell people what you've actually found to be true. Now, we have to approach that with a level of humility. Sometimes we're seeing the world through a keyhole. We should recognize that. Sometimes we can crack the door open a little bit and see more. Sometimes we can swing the door wide open. If we're lucky and have a lot of skill, we can do that. But we don't always do that. So we have to be have humility about this. But when we do get at the truth, when we do get at the facts, we've done our job really well. We should tell people what we've found. And we haven't. That would be the only honest and honorable thing to do.
Amy in Richmond, Virginia, has a question. I'm sure it's on a lot of people's minds. What do you think about how the war in Israel is being represented, covered in the news media here?
I think it's really to address. Who can generalize about the media overall? I think there's a tendency to generalize about the media. It's not if everybody acts exactly the same way. There's a lot of different, be like saying all politicians, all lawyers, all doctors. But people tend not to say that, but they will say the media as if everybody's doing the same thing. Look, it's a really complex story. I'm kind of glad that I'm not in the middle of it, because it's I've been attacked in the past by all parties. For that kind of that coverage, and there's just no satisfying people. I mean, look, the region is, as has been described in a book that I just read, is the history of violence, counter-violence, and counter-counter-violence, and it's a really complex story. And I think the obligation of the press is to cover that story and all of its complexities with a lot of on-the-ground reporting.
And from Dee in Albuquerque, and this goes to what you talked about people knowing the fundamentals of journalism. Her question is, how do journalists determine which are the important stories to cover? For example, war in Gaza starts and most coverage of Ukraine ends. It's a very substantive question and one that we certainly all grapple with every day.
Yeah, these are hard decisions. I mean, a lot of them are based on how much we have in resources. And by the way, when you're covering conflicts like that, there are only so many people on the staff who have experience covering conflict zones. You don't want to just throw anybody into a story like that if you have to be in a danger zone. These are risky things. People don't go into these stories because they're trying to advance an agenda. They're trying to tell people what's actually happening on the ground. Nobody risks his or her life to make some ideological point. These are tough. I mean, the reality is that both of these stories are important. There is still coverage of Ukraine. I know the Post still has quite a few people there. The New York Times does. Other organizations do as well. But obviously, Israel, Gaza is the hotter story. And I mean hot because it's an ongoing, really intense conflict that has huge risks attached to it in a way. Ukraine has huge risks attached to it, too. You try to do both as best you can.
There's also the question of cost. At one point, we analyzed in the Los Angeles Times, figured it was spending $1 million a year to have a bureau in Baghdad. So those are the kinds of very high costs associated with covering, especially foreign conflicts. Douglas wants to know, Are you concerned by the print and TV influence of Sinclair? This would be Sinclair Broadcasting, including its recent purchase of the Baltimore Sun. Sinclair Broadcast, I know at one point, was mandating editorials, conservative editorials that had to air in every single market, every single station that it owned. So what are your thoughts about that, Marty?
About Baltimore or about Sinclair in general?
About Sinclair in general and then Baltimore, because this is, I think, its first foray into print.
Yeah, well, Baltimore was acquired by the CEO of Sinclair individually, not by the company itself. That said, I mean, his comments from the start were quite worrying. He indicated that, that he had an agenda, that he had a political agenda, and that although he didn't say so explicitly, he seemed to signal that that's what the newspaper ought to be pursuing, is pursuing stories that would advance his own political view, his own political views. With regard to Sinclair, yes. I mean, I think that they have certainly leaned to the right and leaned toward Trump. At the Washington Post, we were threatened several times with lawsuits by Sinclair. It seemed to be a pretty, not exactly regular, but not irregular sort of thing, is to get a threatened lawsuit from Sinclair. So, I think that's concerning. I think it's concerning if there's any organization, media organization, that is really trying to advance an ideology in its coverage. That's not our job. Our job is to be independent. And I've always felt independent of any party or any politician.
One thing that's been happening in newsrooms is that younger journalists want to use their positions to put out their personal opinions. That's become a source of friction in some newsrooms. We had a letter from a number of journalists in Los Angeles who were calling for an end to the killing of journalists in Gaza, which is a perfectly legitimate journalist-related thing to do. But then they were talking about how their own papers were covering this and entering into discussions and debate that usually happen within the building on style, tone, substance, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that letter talked about how it said that news organizations should call Israel an apartheid state, that it was engaging in ethnic cleansing and genocide. I think it was a poorly written letter in various ways. I talked about 200 Israelis being captured. They weren't captured. They were taken hostage. I'm opposed to this kind of expression of opinion on social media and elsewhere. I think that's inappropriate. It directly violates the guidelines of most news organizations, by the way. I think that it undermines the reputation of these institutions. I think a lot of the people who are expressing these opinions they're not actually directly involved in these stories, but they're weighing in on them. I think they hurt the ability of their own colleagues to cover these stories in an objective way. A single post on Twitter can draw more attention than an entire project that you've worked on very carefully, and it distorts the reputation of these institutions. I think that reporters and other journalists within news organizations should exercise care and restraint in what they do, and I think too many of them are not exercising care and restraint.
I know, certainly, as you say, the guidelines prohibit a lot of behavior, including donating to campaigns. Our generation, you can't put up lawn signs or exhibit any kind of support for one issue or another. And you certainly can't cover something that you might have a stake in. And so that seems to be a generational shift here. We have time maybe for another question before we wrap up with your final thoughts, Marty. And Joyce in Los Angeles wants to know, where do you go for your daily news? How do you stay informed? I think a lot of people will be taking notes on this one.
Okay. I read a lot. I read the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Atlantic, New Yorker, the Boston Globe, where I work. I've been reading the LA Times. I read my hometown newspaper, the Tampa Bay Times now. I read my local paper, the Berkshire Eagle. I live in Berkshire County and Massachusetts. There are a lot of other things that I look at. I can't recall them all right at the moment, but that's a pretty good, that's pretty much it.
That's a balanced diet.
Maybe too much. Yeah.
Well, so if I can spin off that point, Jim from LA says, what if anything would you like to say about the current health and the future of the LA Times?
Well, look, paper's gone through way too many years of turmoil. It's the paper that I worked at for 17 years, longer than any other newspaper I worked at. I worked there from 1979 to 1996.
Did you get a watch?
I never got a watch. I don't even think I got a little swag, but nothing, you know, that's about it. It's a very important paper, and I think it plays an incredibly important role in covering its region and covering the kinds of issues that are important to its region. A whole range of things, from the environment to immigration to world affairs in various ways. So, all I can say is that I don't want to inject myself into the various controversies that have enveloped that place. It's gone through too many years of instability. Here's what I think, is that everybody there, same as the Post, same as the New York Times, same as the Los Angeles Times, everybody needs to work together to make sure the place is successful, successful journalistically and successful commercially, because one doesn't come without the other. And that means that it has to involve the owner, the editors, the top editors, the journalists, the union, absolutely everybody working together, that really, rather than working at cross purposes, because that is the only way you will find a route to success. And people should figure out how to do that rather than being at each other's throats.
Here is Marty's book. You can buy it. Is it in paperback yet?
Coming out in October, I believe it is.
Paperback version in October, so you can buy more and share it among your friends. This one is here and available now. Marty, we try to end on a hopeful note. Can you give us some hope for the future as we move into this election cycle and beyond?
I think this is, I'm a big reader of history. I read a lot of history. We've gone through really rough times in the past in this country, as we all know. Maybe even rougher than what we're experiencing today. And somehow we find our way through. It's not a straight line. We make progress. I think that's still possible today. And I think the press can play an important role in that. And I think it is endeavoring to do so. We have our faults. We're not perfect. That's because we're human beings. But I think we're working hard at it. And my view is that I try to be optimistic about our profession and about our country, because I think we can't afford not to be.
Can we also say democracy dies without subscriptions?
Yeah, let's say that. Let's say that.
Marty, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to have you here. Your book is really gripping, and thank you for writing it, and thank you for spending time with all of us today.
Great. Thanks, Pat. Thanks for having me. Appreciate
it. Marty Baron was from 2013 to 2021, the editor of the Washington Post in the Bezos era. And as I said, his book is available now and in October in paperback. I want to thank everyone who sponsors this program, who organizes this program, and who watches this program. On Sunday, we'll be talking with Aluf Ben of Haaretz about covering the crisis in Israel. And we'll hope that you will tune in with us then. So thank you very much for joining us this evening.